From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Greece's parliament approved the reforms imposed by the country's European creditors by a 229-64 vote in the 300-seat chamber, with 6 abstentions and 1 absence. The bill's passage was a condition set by Brussels for an 86 billion euro bailout over the next 3 years. In the end, about 3/4 of the parliament's Syriza party members voted in favor of the bill. Although passions are running high among many on the left, who see the deal as a betrayal by Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras and his leftist government, others note that the game has only just begun and point out that there are deeper issues involved that remain to be considered and addressed. One of those is Dr. Richard Wolff, Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and visiting professor at the Graduate Program in International Affairs of the New School University in New York. We spoke with him via Skype from New York Thursday. Thursday morning when we got up, we learned that the Greek parliament passed the series of bills with concessions that Tsipras had brought back. And there has been debate raging all over the world, really, over what this all means. What's your take on it?
Well, I think it's a major moment. I think that's clear. I think it's more of a major moment for Europe than it even is for Greece. That's been my view now for, a year or two, basically, that this is very hard on Greece. That's no question. It's more painful. But in terms of the historical totality, if I could use such an awkward phrase, this is really about European politics, European society and the direction it's taking, and it will shape that, and that's why it's really interesting and I think brings together a number of things that have happened to give us a better understanding, at least I feel that way, about what's unfolding inside Europe, and of which Greece then is simply a part of that story.
Yeah, I mean, I remember back in January when Syriza was elected, thinking myself and a number of other people saying the same thing, that the next task was for them to survive until the Spanish election. And now it is, we're mid-July now. We're way past the halfway point. The concessions that are being asked of Greece, with the exception of the property that was going to be, some of which was going to be seized anyway, the concessions are things that are going to be put off for several years or are reversible. And we're almost at a point where Podemos might be looking at power in Spain, and you can go back to Brussels now, not alone, and perhaps Portugal, and who knows what will happen in Italy and elsewhere. So that's in the background, right, that stuff?
That's in the background, but it cuts both ways, Don, in the sense you could already see yesterday that the right-wing prime minister in Portugal was speaking to the Portuguese people and telling them that their only choice was between pursuing the austerity that his government is already imposing on them at the demand of the Europeans, or descending into something much worse, a la Syriza. In other words, he's saying, don't go in that direction. Don't go in the direction advocated, for example, by the Portuguese Communist Party, which is a strong communist party, and other such forces in Portugal, because it'll end you up in a kind of Syriza dead end. So you're going to see the spin on what has happened cutting both ways as the same struggle is fought out country by country, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Hungary, and so on.
Yeah, Varoufakis even warned about that. He said essentially, I heard the interview that he did with Adams on Monday, and also what he said in the parliament, that if we do this, Golden Dawn, we run the risk of Golden Dawn and those Nazis claiming the mantle of anti-austerity, which is where the people are. And of course, this whole thing with drama was designed from the other side to do that.
Yes, but I think there's a kind of broad lesson about Europe, if I could take it back there,
sure,
that it might be worth teasing out here. And I think the best way to get this across, which is sort of ironic, is to remind everyone of that famous mistake, if that's indeed what it was, made by Mitt Romney in May 2012 in the heat of the campaign against Obama, when he was caught on tape giving a little speech to rich donors in which he made the following basic statement. 47% of Americans, that's the number he used, are lazy, shiftless, dependent on the government, unwilling to care for themselves, dependent people who will always vote for my opponent, Obama, and for the Democrats because they don't want to be taken off the easy ride gravy train that they're on. Whereas the other 53% are hardworking, honorable Americans, and I am saying to them, Mitt Romney, that I will no longer allow your hard work to be taxed to sustain the entitlement, undeserved entitlements of these lazy, good-for-nothing moochers. Okay? I want you to keep that in your mind because I think that's what's going on in Europe. To make it very clear, I think that's exactly what's going on in Europe. I think that Merkel, Schauble, all the others who have been beating up on the Greeks with increasing intensity have exactly that perspective. The difference in Europe is it's not a perspective of people who are in the same country as those they are denouncing. It's Germans that are being appealed by the team to support Merkel and her team in sticking it to the Greeks, but good, painting them in exactly the terms Romney used, and therefore saying, you Germans should support me, Merkel, because I am going to protect you, your hard income taxed to support lazy, shiftless, entitlement drunk Greeks, Portuguese, Spanish, Italians. You fill it in with every ethnic stereotype Germans and other Northern Europeans have a long history of indulging. I think that's the only way to explain a number of phenomena. One, as Varoufakis' interviews also show, the Europeans didn't bargain with him at all. They barely listened to him. He was an annoyance. They were annoyed with him. But the idea that they had to work out a deal, he now understands that was never in their mind. There is no deal. They can't, the German politicians, having done what they did, Merkel, who was unpopular just a few years ago, Merkel has staked her political life on the Romney story. If she now was perceived to have cut any kind of deal that would involve any European money going to them, either as debt relief or as development assistance or anything else, and that it would cost even a minuscule amount to the German taxpayer, her own right wing would kill her. Her own building up of the Romney kind of story would come back and destroy her politically, and so she had no negotiating room. It's not that the Greeks couldn't negotiate. She couldn't. And none of the others can. There was an image burned into my mind about 6 months ago. It was a television image of the parliament in Madrid, Spain. The government there, a government that is now unable even to have a news conference because it doesn't trust the press, let alone the people who have voted it out of office in all but the formal sense over the last 6 months anyway. But the Rajoy government had just announced draconian cutbacks in social welfare, in the right to have a public demonstration, a horrific set of austerity together with civil liberty restriction. And the camera pans to the right wing of the parliament, where all the right wingers, deputies are sitting. And they're standing up and cheering with an intensity on their faces as the speaker announces, and we have now passed the bill that will reduce food subsidies for children. Yay, they yell. I mean, it is so gross. It is almost, it verges on the ghoulish. And that's the lesson here. For these people, the right wing in Europe, which is the leadership now, all across the board, for them, we're not talking one strategy for getting out of a crisis versus another. Krugman a la Keynes, one way, austerity. And they don't care about any of that. That for them is academic shilly-shally debates in which they have no understanding and no interest. For them, this is a morality play. And for countries not so long ago caught up in effective civil wars with wild ideological policies, it's not so surprising that for them, it is Romney. It is the good, hardworking people finally rising up and in righteous indignation, throwing off the tax burden represented by lazy, backward, dependent, ignorant, childlike incompetence. And they are shouting to the ceiling with their freedom from these. It's an amazing thing to what can help explain why every appeal that the Greeks made, for example, about their humanitarian suffering, the suffering of their poor, the setback to their economic future that will last decades, it absolutely fell on totally deaf ears. A Keynesian or an old socialist would stop for a few minutes and recognize something that they were listening to, but they could not for the life of them and certainly could not persuade others to break out of this mindset. So that because it's one country against another, so that the Romney mentality can be woven into a nationalist story of a good country versus bad country, you can see that it's a little easier to pull that stunt off in Europe than it was for Romney here in the United States. But that's the issue, I think, and the left has got to stop thinking that it is dealing here with one or another economic development strategy, one or another law or regulation that can be added or taken away. You're dealing with what has moved, as many of us thought it would, from an economic crisis of capitalism starting in 2008 to now a social, political, and cultural crisis that is going to have to be dealt with by a new left on that basis and not as a detail of economics.
Varoufakis said as much on a number of occasions that this is not an economic dispute but a political one. And certainly, that's true. And the political one representing this, you know, massive social movement of the right that has almost all of the reins of power, both economically and politically in Europe.
Well, I think also that it's wise to keep in mind the larger context. I mean, if we're going to be analysts, we have to explain not just why Germans and Spanish politicians will behave in the way they have, but why they're in the position of doing that in the first place, since they don't invent their politics, they fumble and stumble their way into them. So here's my sense of the context. For the last 30, 40 years, major capitalists in both North America and Western Europe have basically been leaving those areas of the world. They can make more money paying workers a lot less in China, India, Brazil, and so on. With modern aircraft, jet travel, and telecommunications, they can get to those production and distribution facilities in those countries in a matter of hours. They can supervise, monitor, and control what goes on in the office and the factory from their comfortable seats in Berlin or Paris or Rome or New York or Chicago. And what that has meant is that they're leaving, they're abandoning the North American and Western European sites of their origin and of modern capitalism's origins. And they're doing it for the same reason that they developed in those parts of the world. It was profitable there then. It's more profitable someplace else. And that leaves behind workers who can't get jobs, wages that cannot and will not go up anymore. Therefore, cities and towns that are losing revenue as businesses close, as wages stagnate. And so what you have is a long-term economic decline. That's what the politicians of Western Europe, Germany, Greece, Spain, and North America, United States, Canada, which, by the way, is going into a recession as we speak. They're all presiding, these politicians, unhappily for them, over a capitalism in decline. And they're having to get used to what that means. How do you keep power as a Republican, a Democrat, a liberal, a socialist, a conservative? How do you keep power with a new language and a new ideology to handle a declining capitalism? Well, the conservatives figured it out first and better than the liberals on the left. The conservatives said, okay, in a period of decline, everybody is scared witless by what's happening and what's in store for them next year, for their kids, and so on. So the way you win votes is by trying to appeal to a significant subset of those in the process of being screwed and tell them, hey, vote for me because I will protect you. And so even if you're screwed, you'll be screwed less and more slowly than other people who I will not protect. In this country, it then becomes clear. You have people like Governor Walker in Wisconsin. He's going to protect the majority of private sector workers in Wisconsin by not taxing them to support the lazy, shiftless public employees, and he goes on the warpath against those. That's basically an appeal to Wisconsin workers, all of whom are getting shafted, that they will do better by voting for him because he'll really stick it to the public employees and he'll really stick it to the folks on welfare, but he won't stick it so badly to the rural, small city, private enterprise, private employee voters that he faces. In other parts of the country, this will take its classic racist form, in which the blacks will be portrayed as the ones we will no longer tax you to support, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very clever way to adapt to the latest circumstances, the old divide and conquer mentality, that the way the businesses in power will support a politician is if that politician keeps himself in office by using their money and a political pitch that separates a big chunk of the workers from one another in support of the very thing that's screwing them, but in the idea that they will get a candidate into office who will screw them less than he screws other parts of the working class.
Now, that's a pretty dangerous game to play again in Europe because it didn't work out so well last time when they did that in the 30s.
No, it's amazing. You know, just a personal message. My mother was born in Berlin, Germany. My first language is German. That's what I grew up speaking. I was born in the United States, but, you know, if you live in a home where your mother is German, you speak German. So I have, therefore, always, I'm fluent in German now, I always have been. I go to Germany, I give talks in German and all the rest. So I follow the events in Germany. I just want to underscore the correctness of what you're saying. For German people to be building a politics around a hideous caricature of other ethnically different, although no more the Greeks from Germans than the Jews were from Germans, but to play that game for a politician like Merkel to do this either means that she's monumentally stupid and ignorant about her own history, which I find hard to imagine but possible, or else she is so driven by the problems of her own political situation that she simply cannot care less about long-term consequences. She's found a way to recoup her popularity. By the way, just a footnote. German workers have been suffering. Yes, nothing like the Greek or the Spanish, but German workers have had to take their lumps. They have had an austerity. Their banks also failed. Their government bailed out those banks and is making the working class pay for it. They've converted the old German social democracy into a very porous, inadequate safety net. A huge number of Germans work in very precarious short-term labor contracts. So there's a lot of bitterness in the German working class, and they have opposition parties. So Merkel was in trouble. She has recouped herself with playing the nationalist anti-Greek card, this Romney-esque version of vote for me, I'll protect you from even worse suffering than you've gone through by not burdening you with taxes to support those lazy Greeks. And yes, it's a very dangerous game, but it shows you that the posture of the German government, that they are secure, is exactly that, a posture. They're very worried. They had to do this. And I think that's a sign of the splits and the tensions building inside Europe, of which this Greek moment is just that, one step in a very dangerous process. I think the left in Europe is being taught intensely that it's going to have to confront what is going on. It's going to have to make a counter strategy that has no shortcut other than build the unity of the working class against the capitalist class, not because you like the ideological sound of it, but because that best describes what you're doing. You're going to have to end capitalism. You're not going to permit capitalist enterprises to get up and leave. You're going to use your political power as the majority, the working class, to reverse economic development of the last 20 years. You're going to have to work that out with your counterparts in China, India, and Brazil. They're not going to go back to what they were. That's out of the question. But you're not going to continue to allow this because you can see. That's what Greece teaches everybody. You can see where it's going. Greece is the future of Europe, the way Detroit is the future of the United States, unless the mass recognition of what that means becomes the basis of an anti-capitalist politics.
So far, it seems that the folks that I see communicating about this see Syriza rather than the bourgeoisie or the policy-making politicians as the enemy, the betrayer, they're calling every name under the sun. What, in fact, has to be done to support, to build on what Syriza has accomplished, which is actually quite considerable in the short term, considering it's only been 6-7 months that they've been in government?
I'm not going to participate at all in this dumping on Syriza. They had a very, very difficult situation. Mm-hmm. They did the best they could. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence that I see that they behaved other than what they said they were trying to do.
Agreed.
So I won't participate in, number one. Number two, the political prowess of Syriza is the envy of the left anywhere else in the world if they're honest. Mm. They went from a political party of 3-4% on the usual margins of European politics, and in a very short number of years become the governing party and dare to call a referendum, which they overwhelmingly win. That means that they have rallied around themselves a majority of Greeks. Given the long divisions of Greek politics, that's really an amazing achievement. And if you add to that the extraordinary pressure against their achieving all of that coming from outside the country, it's an achievement even more. So I have a lot of confidence in that party, in the people in it, because of a proven record of excellent behavior and extraordinary success under very difficult conditions. Having said that, if I were pressed, I think the mistake is the one that my earlier comments point to, if I'm right about European politics. If I'm pressed, I would also say I draw upon Varoufakis' interviews. Here's the problem. The ultimate things leaving the European Union, making an effort outside through contacts with Russia, China, Latin America, through self-development, through a concerted redistribution of wealth and power inside Greek society, which is the unspoken other side of all of this, they should have had a plan to make that either a reality or a believable threat. And that means they could not have relied, as Varoufakis says, on having a group of five people working on what a return to the drachma might look like. He's quite right to say that's way too few, although why he couldn't get more people to do that is a mystery to me, and why Syriza didn't understand that given what the level of European opposition would likely be, they had to have a serious alternative plan, or else they would be called, in a sense, on a bluff. If you assume, in addition, that either the US NSA or the German security services were able to listen to the conversations that Syriza's leadership had and knew that they didn't have much of an alternative, then it becomes easier to understand why they were willing to carry the bluff to the end and knew that the Greeks couldn't because they hadn't done the work. It meant that in the 5 or 6 months where they had all the apparatus of government to do it, they made a classic mistake. They didn't do it. They took seriously the process of negotiation with the Europeans, and that suckered them into a dead end, which is now being played out. And by the way, this suggests nothing so much as the remarkable comments of Karl Marx when in the early 1870s, he wrote a very famous pamphlet trying to explain why the first successful worker takeover of the government, the Paris Commune of 1870, why it fell apart after 4 or 5 months. And his answer was they had a set of illusions about bourgeois capitalist institutions and how they worked and what a revolutionary workers' government would have to do to make them work otherwise. So they left the bank in its normal form and so on. And for Marx, that was their undoing. Something like that has to be now understood in terms of what is going to happen if one country, whether it's a little one like Greece or a huge one like Spain, really has a government that is unwilling to play by the capitalist rules that now govern Europe, such as austerity is the way you handle capitalism's crash of 2008 and the expensive bailouts that you use to get out of it.
And we will continue that conversation as things develop. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.